This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Alec Murdaugh is going back to trial at some point, probably next year, maybe the next, who really knows. But there's a lot of things happening in Alec Murdaugh Trial Part 2 that probably didn't happen in Alec Murdaugh Trial Part 1. We're going to discuss all of it, from what the defense is building, what the prosecution is up against, and the third bonus lawsuit that's currently in progress, the civil suit against Becky Hill from Alec Murdaugh. We're going to get into all of it today. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, is with myself and Robin Drake to break all of it down. Recently, Dick Harpootalian went on TV, basically announced his playbook, set his team as a strategy for the Kennel video, the one piece of evidence that really destroyed Alec Murdaugh's alibi the first time. Jim Griffin pointed to unknown male DNA under Maggie Murdaugh's fingernails that was never run through CODIS. They're hiring a new forensic cell phone expert, pushing for venue changes, and they filed that federal lawsuit against Becky Hill. Does it all matter? Is it posturing by the defense to make old news seem new again? Or are we truly going to find some new investigative details? That's what we're going to dig in here to today. We're going to start with the defense of Alec Murdaugh before we go over to the prosecution and the Becky Hill suit. Let's start with Dick's statement going on national TV. Said his team is a strategy for the Kennel video. That's the one piece of evidence that shattered Alex's alibi the first time. Said he wasn't down there. And then there he is, talking on camera, talking to the dog about the guinea fowl that the dog ate. And oh, what a tangled web we weave, as Alec would say. Bob, how are they going to repackage and represent this to a jury that's going to read differently round two?
Just when I thought I was out.
Look, here's the deal. I'm actually super fascinated about this trial.
I am too. Yeah.
Oddly enough, it's going to be tough. I mean, look, the Kennel video is a thing that you don't beat it, right? I mean, it exists. There's no turning back the hands of time. There's no undoing what was said during the first trial, transcripts of every single word that was uttered. So that's all there. And you have Alex admitting that he lied about it. What you do is you reframe what it proves. Mm-hmm. All right. So like, simply put, you're not going to beat the Kennel video. You reframe it in a way that you're saying presence isn't a trigger pull. You know, just because he was there doesn't mean he's the guy who shot them. That's all you can do with it. There is no getting rid of it. It's there. It does what it does. You can hear who you hear. There's no, that wasn't me. You know, like none of that exists. So best thing they can hope to do with it is reframe it in a way that says, okay, well, you know, there's an axiom in the law. Mere presence is not enough. You need more. And that holds true. So we'll see what they do with it.
And that's true. I mean, but just saying that, you know, it doesn't, it's not going to weigh very well for a jury of it doesn't prove that he did it. True. It doesn't. I can agree, but they're going to want more. They're going to want a story. They're going to want, you know, something beyond, well, you can't prove he pulled the trigger on video. Okay. Well then who did? How do we get there? Are we going to get into a third party culprit type situation, you think?
That's what I was just going to say. You got
tell me.
You better start digging. You better start digging. Yeah. Try to figure out. I mean, look, there's one fact that is absolute gospel. There are a lot of people that had beef with that guy. You know, the question is, can you narrow it down to the people that he had wronged that were aware of it? That's the key in the whole thing, because a lot of like your typical lawyer that's funneling their clients' funds are constantly coming up with bullshit excuses as to why they haven't dispersed the money. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always some excuse. So you need to figure out which of his clients, if you're going to start there as a possible third party culprit, knew that he had the money and he hadn't turned it over. you know, mm-hmm. because if they've been fed excuses, most people, you know, they may be suspicious, but they tend to believe what their lawyer is saying to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think that anybody that he was feeding whatever lies he was feeding to all these folks that he was bilking all their money, got to the point where they're like, all right, this guy stole my shit. You know, I'm taking care of him, or I'm going to get revenge by killing his wife and his son. You know what I mean?
That's my question there then. So why not go after him and why go after his wife and son, who, especially his wife, you know, had a great reputation of just being a nice person, you know? And so
that is easy. He's the breadwinner. I mean, like, are you going to, if there's,
because if you want your money repaid,
your money back, are you going to kill the only person who can bring it in? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but then why not leakage about some sort of letter, some sort of retribution, some sort of path forward for him to not have this happen? I mean, you'd think there'd be more data supporting that this was, again, I'm saying if the defense is going to use this third party because it's retribution against him, then there's got to be more than they're just dead. I mean, there was got to be a path forward for him, you know, kind of like we're talking about in Nancy Guthrie. If the intent is to get money, they got to make it easy to get the money. And there's got to be leakage along that path. And I agree, you know, it's a good strategy to go on third party, but I don't know about the whole, you know, targeting the family.
I mean, like what else, like the other part of it, the other piece, I think that you'd want to focus on if you're the defense is his drug trade activity. You know, yes. I mean, there's no question the guy was dealing. There's no part of me that thinks that he was taking the amount of drugs that Greenwater was putting out there at trial that he was consuming on a monthly basis. There's no way. No human can eat that much drugs. So, you know, was cartel activity involved with this? Was this like I don't know the depths of procurement of the drugs that he was dealing, who he was getting it from, if it was on consignment, meaning he's not fronting the money, but he's getting the drugs, selling the drugs, and then paying for the drug. I don't know any of those questions. Those are things that his defense team would have to dig into if they're looking at that angle. You know, again, at the end of the day, you're still stuck with that same thing. I think it's probably an easier sell to a jury with respect to if you could somehow make a link to the cartel, they're pretty infamous for knocking people's families off. You know what I mean? Like that's an easier sell to get a jury to buy because of the issues that you're talking about, Robin. Like, well, where's the paper trail of the person that's saying, hey, you know, if you don't do this, if I don't get this money, you know, I'm doing this to your family type thing. Where does that exist in the world? Or why didn't he come forward and just say that existed in the world? You know what I mean? At the first trial.
And I guess let's examine that for a second. If they're going to go down the cartel route, what kind of legs that would possibly have and what the prosecution could try and knock out under them. Does this look like a cartel hit? Are there signs that show that it does, Bob?
I mean, it's a little sloppy, but I don't know that every cartel hit is super clean. You know what I mean? Like the level of violence is something that they really try to harp on. You know,
was there.
That was certainly there, you know.
But what about the weapons? Because they didn't, they whoever did this supposedly used Murdaugh's actual weapons. I could be wrong. I don't have a stat on this. Maybe there is, but I don't believe.
Up, you know,
how often are the cartels showing up at a residence and using the, you know, the weapons of the homeowner to take out the person and depending on them to be there and ready and loaded and ammo's ready versus showing up with their own weaponry. That's the part that I think loses me on the cartel end of things. What are your thoughts?
Robin looked that up. I'm sure Robin's on
top. I did. Yeah. Professional execution style isn't there. It's bottom line for retrial. I just redid it right now, and I looked it up back when we brought this up a number of weeks ago. You have to weave a good story on this one, because whereas there is cartel infiltration in this area in the prison system, I looked up that as well. There to claim what the defense would have to claim as this being a cartel hit, it would be a blip. In other words, they couldn't say this falls a normal behavior or pattern of the way the hits are done, retribution hits, number of drugs, you know, all those things. It doesn't fit what they would typically do. It would have to be a blip that then prosecution would then say, well, then why this? Why this? Why this? Why this? This doesn't fit. This doesn't fit. This doesn't fit. Because it's a stretch. We think it makes sense because it seems so abhorrent, that number. And Bob, I agree. That number of pills he was claiming to take and the price of them seems like no human being could sustain that. But I looked up this on the science side of it. That is actually plausible, not exactly to the exaggerated amount, but really well within that bounds of human beings, of the tolerance he can build and still be functional at that. Shocked the shit out of me. But according to this research, it is plausible and possible. So it's not, it's possibly, in other words, he was ingesting it and not going for resale of it. I think, though, I agree. I think if they're going to lodge I'm just telling you, I agree. I don't understand how he could live either.
It was like 90 grand a month or some crazy number.
Was
like,
he overpaying? Was he being ripped off? I mean, maybe that's it. Maybe he was just like really stupid with what he was buying.
Yeah, he's just getting fleeced.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the answer.
He's got that Murdoch money, man. Yeah. We're going to fuck this guy over.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, but the thing is with the cartel or something with the drugs.
Let me read it for
you. Okay, go for it.
Up to 60 oxycodone pills per day, he testified, was at the peak of his addiction. Most were 30 milligram pills. That equals 1,800 milligrams of oxycodone per day. Weekly total, 420 pills per week. Typical street price for 30 milligram oxycodone pill, $20 to $40 each. An average of $30 pill. Total cost $1,800. Weekly cost $12,600. The $50,000 per week figure, as his lawyer cited, lines up if he was paying premium top end prices or he was buying significantly more pills than he was personally taking. But it's within that realm. So those are the numbers.
It's a lot.
A lot of pills, bro. Man.
No, he'd probably get the Guinness people interested in a conversation
with him. Which to me seems why you do something stupid like kill your wife and son, because you're so hopped up on that so much shit.
Yeah.
And thinking that is a great way, and you thinking it's a great way to garner sympathy in a fucked up brain so hopped up on oxycodone.
I want to talk about the cartel thing for a second, because it doesn't have to be an all or nothing equation where drugs were involved and this was then cartel. There's plenty of drugged out, doped out dealers in South Carolina's low country on you name it that are wandering around, have some semblance of organization, that are not the cartel, that probably have access to weapons, maybe know the Murdaughs a bit, maybe have dealt with him, maybe have dealt to him before, that maybe would have access or know where the weapons are on his property. I'm wondering if it is something involving drugs, involving something that did go wrong, something where he didn't pay for them or whatever it may be, not necessarily cartel related, but drug dealer related, gang related, or something of that nature. Somebody that he pissed off to some level involving the drugs and money that came forward. I feel like that could be it. I don't feel like it has to be immediately cartel or nothing.
Right? Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of people that hated that guy.
Sure, exactly.
Like the boat accident, the clients he's ripping off, potential drugs. Look, there is a bountiful number of people that they could try to dig into in order to get the thing. I've been pretty vocal since the first trial what my theory is. But my theory is a true crime theory. It's not a defense theory, because my theory ends up with him as a principal and he's going down as if he pulled the trigger himself. Know what I'm saying? So like if I'm defending Murdoch, I can't put forth what I think happened here. But, you know, for the defense, I mean, there is ample opportunity, but they're going to have to create some kind of nexus. It can't just be there's got to be some kind of knowledge. There's got to be some kind of existing threat that they're able to kind of prove up. And they're going to have to be able to put somebody in or around that area at the time. You know, I mean, they're going to have some connective tissue. You can't just throw shit out that's got nothing. You know what I mean? You can't just throw out names in order to, you know, get the jury to squirrel, you know? Look there, you know what I mean? That's not how it works. So, it's going to be an interesting case for a lot of reasons, which I'm sure we're going to get into. But yeah, how they're going to go about defending the video again, that's the easiest of the bunch. Because that really is a reframing type of thing wherein, you know, it's not implausible to think that he was on the property and he was down there minutes before, especially in my theory. But again, my theory is not the one that, like, the defense could ever employ, because it's basically saying my guy did it. He just didn't pull the trigger.
And I looked up for us both drug dealer retribution, local as well as cartels. Here's what they typically do, and this does not fit the pattern. Typically, they'll do something such as extreme torture, mutilation, public display or bodies left as warnings, no narco mantas messages, or symbolic claims of responsibility. So the claim of responsibility would be a big part of it somewhere in there. Weapons were consistent with guns already on the rural property, rifle maggie, shotgun for ball. Scene lacked the coordinated professional or terror style elements common in cartel hits or local drug dealer hits.
Yep. Yep. I mean,
it's impossible. It's a stretch. It would be that'd be the stretch at defense. I mean,
I think that the angle would probably be that the cartel used some local dipshits, you know, that are like low level cartel guys in the States for them.
Yeah.
You know, just a couple of schmucks that are like probably using and dealing, and they're like, go handle this shit. But
yeah, they hired Badger. Like from Breaking Bad, Badger when he handled it. You know, it's the same.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, it kind of might be what, who knows? Another piece that they're touting here, and it sounds, I mean, it's like, ooh, this sounds like this could mean something. This could be something. Unknown male DNA recovered under Maggie Murdaugh's fingernails.
Right.
Never run through CODIS. Now, okay, I don't know why it wouldn't be run through CODIS. That seems like a failing on the part of the investigators. And unknown male DNA under someone's, that sounds spooky. Well, until you look up the stats. Your odds of having someone's unknown DNA underneath your fingernails at any given time in your life, pretty high.
Pretty high.
I would imagine all of us probably have some unknown DNA under our fingernails if we've been out in the ether of our world, or went to a store or picked up products or did anything for any period of time involving where other people go. It's a high number. So
yeah, and plus, look, this wasn't a hand-to-hand combat crime. Like, I saw no...
True.
No evidence presented that Maggie had gotten any kind of defensive wounds on her, or, you know, other than the gunshot wounds. It seemed it was from a distance, you know. So this thing is like, to me, it's just not a thing. You know, it's good for the media if they're trying to go out there and get a narrative out there. But I think that if I remember correctly, you know, they addressed this in the first trial, you know, and SLED had said that they pulled a partial Y chromosome, like YSTR, and that ultimately they didn't have enough loci to load it into CODIS. I think Robin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you need 20 loci minimum to be listed in CODIS, and they weren't able to
pull on it either. From it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's what the number is in order to be in CODIS. If it doesn't reach that threshold, you're not going to be in CODIS. Like they have like a threshold minimum that has to be met in order for anybody's or any profile to be listed in CODIS. And I don't think that there was enough there from it, but beyond that, like you were saying, Tony, I mean, you know, the transfer DNA aspect of this, in combination with the fact that it didn't seem that there was any kind of hand-to-hand combat, there was no struggle, you know, with Maggie and whoever did this, if it was Alec or anybody else, you know. So to me, it's a non-starter.
Sounds neat on paper, though.
Yeah.
Gets you going. And then it's like, oh, okay. It's clickbaity.
It's total surface level bullshit. You know what I mean? If you like, anybody that's going to look into it at all is going to be like,
yeah, exactly. Your thoughts on the defense of Alec Murda? We're not sitting here saying he's innocent. We're examining it from how what cards do they have to play? And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description or in our live chat as we're doing this right now. Creighton Waters told reporters after the Supreme Court ruling that the genie is out of the bottle. Every potential juror already knows the Murda saga, but the court just told his team they can't present it the way they did the first time either. Prosecutors, they spent 12 and a half hours on financial crimes testimony in the original trial. The Supreme Court called it excessive, prejudicial, and said it went far beyond what was necessary. Now the AG's office has to prove the same Murda case with its strongest narrative weapon on a leash. A defense that has seen every card in the deck in a jury pool saturated in 3 years of coverage. Bob Mata, host of Defense Diaries, is with us to break down what the prosecution may have up their sleeve this time in the next trial of Alec Murda. There's a ton of witnesses that are going to come back for a repeat experience. Let me ask this, Bob, as a defense attorney, in a retrial type situation, when you are bringing witnesses back to the stand, you're going to question them. They're going to give their testimony. What happens if their testimony doesn't quite line up with the same way it lined up the first time? Is that something that then the defense can bring up during the actual trial going, wait a second, you just impeached yourself from what you said in round one. And I guess what is the bar on that? Because I'm sure they're ready to make mountains out of molehills because it will certainly be exciting in front of a jury. And when you're talking about a crime that committed this many years ago, everyone is human. The mind may sometimes be off on certain things. I'm not saying like massively different stories like Alec pitched of being at the kennels or not. I'm saying just little nuances here and there, things like that. What could be impeached? What will be pointed at? Is it literally, you better say pretty much exactly what you said or they're going to be all over you?
Yeah, I mean, look, if it's a prior inconsistent statement, you do exactly what you said. You impeach him on it. You know, you basically, with the transcripts, it's that testimony's locked in. It was under oath. It was in a courtroom. No one could ever say it was hearsay because it's not. So, you know, what you do if you're the defense, and it goes for Creighton Waters as well. You know, I mean, if the defense is going to put it on any experts or anybody that was a witness in the first trial and they have inconsistent statements, the state obviously has the ability to be able to impeach them too. But if you're going to nitpick on things that are really of no significance, it's going to damage you. It's got to be something substantive that is being
changed. Could they also, I mean, so if you're doing that and putting me on the stand, I can say, can you please refresh my memory on what I said last time? And I'll just say, yeah, that again. And is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly say, I don't recall, like if they ask you what you said during the first trial. But typically the way that the impeachment goes is you got to lay the trap, you know, you got to perfect the impeachment. So, typically there's going to be a questions asked and they'll know ahead of time or they'll have a pretty good idea, but they're going to have all these areas marked in terms of the transcripts from the first trial wherein they're going to test the waters to see if they change their answers. And then if they do at that point, then they'll impeach them at that point. But they've got to get them saying something different at this trial, and then once they perfect the impeachment, then they can go back and impeach him with what they said at the prior trial. But again, it's not going to be nuanced turns of phrases that you're impeaching. You know, saying the same thing, but saying it in a different way is an impeachment. You know,
right, because it's completely plausible over periods of time, watching news, watching social media, that your recollection of what happens, the timing of it, what came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, that can shift around a bit after periods of time and listen to other people and their thoughts, their opinions, watching true crime shows. I mean, there's a lot of things that can start shifting. It's not going to shift from the core, but how that core is delivered, that can shift and still be accurate. That's why I'd say I would want to know where what I said the last time, because to refresh my memory from to clear the fog of all the other shit that infused it between then and now.
Yeah, well, I am sure that Creighton Waters is going to prep his witnesses.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, sure, sure.
You know, we're like, that's the advantage for both sides in a retrial.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, you're plugging in holes. If there's soft spots that are existent in testimony, you're trying to get that thing fixed. And, you know, no one's going to be surprised by anything that comes out. Now, from the defense side of it, it's a little bit different because we know what Creighton's case is. The interesting part about Creighton's case is that they've trimmed so much of the financial crime stuff in terms of what he's going to be able to do, that it's going to be a different case in chief that they're going to put on. It's going to be shorter, which is fine. He didn't need to do 12 hours, which equaled, I don't know how, like 2 weeks or whatever.
Yeah, it was like a week and a half of...
It went on forever.
Yeah.
It went on forever. It was too much because his motive, which is why he needed the financial crime stuff. It was the whole gathering storm. His famous little, it was the gathering storm.
In Family Annihilator, we learned that term. You know? We learned that term in the trial too.
Yeah, and we've talked about this in other cases. So where do you, because I... The arc, you know, leading up to this, if you don't actually have a confession, you don't actually have, you know, his DNA, you know, whatever it is that the hard evidence in that moment, you were saying on another case, and you know, that you can't use all those prior things saying that it led up to this as kind of, you know, past his prologue kind of moments. So without doing that with him, how do you do it? How do they build that case? And how come they can't use those things?
Well, they can. I mean, the Supreme Court didn't tell him, and I'm talking about the Supreme Court of South Carolina. They didn't tell him that he can't get into it. They just said you can't wallow in it. You know what I mean? It's like he can certainly get into the fraud, but they just got to trim all the fat and just get right to it. And look, here's the reality. Whether or not they prevail on their change of venue, which I suspect they will, everybody knows about this case. But I say that kind of tongue in cheek, because us in the true crime world, we think that everybody knows everything about every case. Nobody knows shit about anything. We're a bunch of weirdos talking about true crime all the time. You go 8 out of 10 people, if you're walking down the street in any kind of major city, you say, hey, what do you think about that Murdoch case? Be like, what?
Yeah.
Pop. I looked up the DNA. There was not enough on that sample taken to be loaded into CODIS.
I totally agree. I mean, sometimes you throw a case out there and then you really hear what people are actually absorbing from the case. And it's like, no, that's not what's happening at all. So you got that going on. Let me ask you this, Bob, as a defense attorney, when it comes into a retrial, a situation like this, a case that is obviously locally known, nationally known here, what are the pros and cons here of jury selection on a retrial? Is it more difficult because there's far more people who are going to have an opinion? Is it better because when the ones that don't have an opinion really don't have an opinion because they're that far removed and this is not in their ether and part of their lexicon and at all? Tell me about that. What are they looking at when it comes to jury selection, whether this happens there in Hampton County or if it's moved to another location?
You are absolutely, if you're the defense, looking for people that legitimately don't know anything about the case. If you're Creighton, you want people knowing all about the case.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's, I don't know how many docuseries there's been on this, but there's been quite a few. Tons of podcasts, you know, tons of coverage in true crime in general. But again, like you said, if that's not in your ether and there's, you know, I'm always surprised that people are like, yeah, true crime's a niche or niche, whichever way you pronounce it. I'm a niche guy because I'm from Chicago. But I think that there's a large portion of the population that doesn't get into true crime. If you're the defense, those are the folks that you want, because you want a trimmed down motive in terms of what he's going to be able to produce in terms of the fraud. Okay. So if you're talking like you're trimming it down from 12 hours to 90 minutes, and I never loved personally, I did not love at all that motive. Like to me, it was a bit of a hard sell.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that Creighton is going to have to really work on that in terms of that motive theory. You know, I mean, he sold it, or did he? I don't know. I mean, Murdoch was such a piece of shit that he's getting convicted either way.
Yeah, can you pivot that much away from that original motive during during his new prosecution?
I mean, I don't know.
Do you really need to pivot away from it, though? Do you need to just do a better job at explaining it to the jury like they're 3-year-olds or just anybody? Because it is kind of a bizarre concept until you've seen it in action, because there's plenty of cases where there are family annihilators. But I guess how well can you educate a jury on that in this sort of a setting, Bob? How much will a court let in to go, here's examples of what a family annihilator? I mean, can you do that? What kind of a leash are you on to educate someone on a foreign concept, on what a family annihilator really is, for people who don't even think that a human being could be capable of this? No one could ever do that. Surprise, they do.
It's going to be fought in motions in limine, but essentially the state would have to get an expert. You know, I mean, they'd have to get an expert to educate the jury on it. And if the judge found that it would be helpful to the jury, then the judge will allow that expert to come in and talk about it. Because frankly, it's a hard concept.
It is.
To get people to understand how anyone could do that to their own child and their wife. Like, not so much the wife, because you see it so often, because people are fucking idiots.
Right.
And, yeah. You know, instead of getting divorced, they decide to kill their spouse, which is just, I'll never understand that. I'll never understand it.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as like the level of violence in terms of Paul's death,
yeah,
in terms of his entire skull being blown open, is insane to me that a father could do that. So do I think there's value in having an expert come in and explain to a jury in what set of circumstances that this can arise, that this is a thing, that it does happen? I mean, you can make the argument that Corey Richens was also a gathering storm case.
Yeah, completely.
You know, I mean, her story's not so different. That motive is not so different than Murdoch's motive. I mean, his was a little more insane, but the same problems. It was money problems,
yeah,
you know, and it was shit was coming down the pike, you know. But his concept, Creighton's concept, that, you know, like this was a sympathy bomb that Murdoch thought he was detonating, that was going to somehow, you know, squirrel everybody's attention away from him, and they're all going to be feeling so sympathetic that they're not going to be looking at the fact that he was a thief. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, obviously, when you think about it as a logical person, you know, it's insane. But this goes back to what Robin was saying. You know, if this guy was popping, and it doesn't have to be that insane amount of pills, if he's using all day, every day, no matter what the volume is, he's not thinking clearly at all. You know what I'm saying? He's dealing in a murky world. And, you know, he's just not processing things properly. And, you know, in his warped mind, that may have been a way to say, all right, well, this is kind of a move. Maybe this will work. You know, he had to know that there was no long play there, like that was only going to last for so long, that the chickens were still coming home to roost at some point.
Yes.
So, you know, which is, you know, and that's the thing where, to that question exactly about how do you get in this kind of concept of a family annihilator,
mm-hmm,
it would have been helpful for me if I were on the jury, because that was one of the harder things for me to kind of grapple with, because I knew enough about Murdoch and that family history and his history with his wife and his kids that you could tell that he genuinely, truly love them, and that his, mm-hmm, life until he spun out of control with the drug use and like what that's a chicken or the egg thing for me. I don't know what came first, the drug use, or if he started pilfering the money, or if he started pilfering the money because of the drug. I don't know. I don't know that answer in terms of when that started. But what I do know, and I felt very secure in believing, is the fact that this guy had deep affection for his family.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard place for me to get to think that he could have done that by his own hand, which is why I've always been of the theory that, and again, it's not a defense theory because it puts him as a principal. You hire two goofballs, two badgers to do this, two local clowns. You're saying, you're using my guns on the property. I'm going to dispose of them. I don't trust you morons to do anything with them. I'll get rid of them. You get these two guns, you do the damn thing. You let me know that it happened and I'm off. You know what I mean? And like, I'm going to call you and give you, I to me, it made more sense in terms of him going down to the kennels and he's like, all right, you know, he calls the two clowns that are sitting off the property and is like, yo, they're down there. Go do this damn thing and whatever. And then he holes up in the house and these two guys or whatever come and do this awful shit. And then he grabs the guns and goes to his mother's property and does whatever he's going to do with the guns because he doesn't want these two guys out in the world with evidence that can convict them. Like, that's always been kind of like my concept of like, but again, that's only because I have a hard time grappling because I am a father of four.
Sure.
I can't bring my mind to ever. No. There ever being a situation.
I think that as well. And here's the behavior behind it, not just because we can't wrap our minds around it because we're fathers and we can't imagine such an abhorrent thing, but also, as his housekeeper was saying, he never did anything for himself. And so this, in other words, him having not hired someone would be a blip in his normal everyday behavior of having someone do his dirty work, his laundry, his making his food, doing things for him. He always had someone hired hand doing something. So that would actually would fit a pattern in his behavior. And I'm of the mindset of doubling down on that family annihilator thing of it, them. You don't even need, I think, in other words, like to your point, Bob, you don't know what came first, the drugs, drug addiction issues or dealing with bad money situations. You can ignore the money entirely, focus on the drug issues and the drug issues causing the cascading effect of a family annihilator. And that is what prosecution goes down as to why he did X, Y, and Z. But then it runs into the muddy water of hiring someone. But that's, again, on the defense side. But that all kind of fits to me as well.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, the equation here, I was kind of like literally writing out like plus signs, minus signs. If you can get character witnesses to show what his state of mind was like in the day or two leading up to this, if they can get people to show he was fucking drugged up, he was not the, like, whatever they have to say. I don't know what it would be, but if you have that, that would be powerful. You mix in the examples of his narcissistic lifestyle that he basically lived, and then you have something to explain family annihilation a bit, what that does to someone with that sort of a mindset, the ego, the shame, the image, all piling down, which does kind of go to family annihilator, but I don't think you need to go family annihilator full stop. And you add one more thing in, drug use. So yeah. State of mind, narcissism to a fucking T, to an extreme, the ego, the shame, the image that is all falling away, add a couple drugs to that, and it suddenly makes it plausible that this person would eliminate his family. He's ashamed that they're going to look at him differently. They're also the people, his son is someone who really kind of brought the cards falling down through the boat crash, all of his crimes, financial crimes being exposed through that lever. So you got to imagine, even though it's your son, you got some rage there. You got some resentment there. Maybe they want to kill your son, but you're mad. And Maggie's about to leave him. So there's a lot of things there that show Alec wasn't in the best family state with these folks at that moment in time. And you lower the inhibitions, you lower the decision-making process through the drugs, it becomes not so impossible. And that's what they probably need to try and communicate to a jury.
Enough because of his drug use to be aware of it.
You know, well, I mean, look at so how he was when the cops came. I mean, we saw how he was when we have the, you know, his interview in his white shirt when they show up at the crime scene.
Yeah, and yeah,
I'm talking about the, you know, kind of the details of the things that you're talking about. Like, did they ever, I cannot recall Mm-hmm. Did they ever, were they able to show that Maggie actually had gone to a divorce attorney?
I believe they did. I could be wrong, but I believe it was part of the first trial in some way, shape, or form.
And does Murdoch know it? You know what I mean? To me, knowledge is always the key.
Right. Like,
people can't be worried about shit that they don't know.
Well, she wasn't living with him. She was living at the beach house. So I think one can at least glean there was knowledge there, but I would imagine, I don't know. I don't know. Do not know the answer to that, but I would say your odds are probably good that there's going to be some way to show that.
See, and I think that that's more related to, you know, the fact that either Paul or Buster, I can't remember which one, found like his stash. You know, obviously they're going to Maggie. They're like, dad's still using. It was not, the family was not oblivious to the fact that Alec was using.
No, everybody knew he was.
Right. So, you know, Maggie, in terms of like what the impetus of that divorce was, probably had nothing to do with the financials, as I think that he probably was hiding that fact from her. Yeah. The drug use and she was doing I don't know, man. I still don't love that motive. I just don't.
I don't either. But it seems, I think there's a way to present it in a more clear way than was done on round
one. What about like, was Cousin Eddie or whatever the fuck that guy's name was? He was that like an actual attempt?
Like, well, he was shot.
He actually supposed to kill him, or like, are we supposed to believe that guy? Whatever, is it Cousin Eddie? Is that his name?
Yeah, it's Cousin Eddie. Yeah.
So is Cousin Eddie enough of a crack shot that he can just make sure that he just skims the crazes the top?
Well, Eddie said he didn't do it. Eddie said he wouldn't do it, and that Alec did it to himself.
And
it was like he was shocked, like he didn't know what Alec wanted, and that he's like, I'm not going to shoot you, like that's insane, and he was going to try and pin it in that direction. But I mean, there's a lot of theories, and I'm not saying Cousin Eddie killed them, but there's a lot of people who look at that and go, was he the hitman? I personally don't believe that. I'm interested in hearing any theories.
The whole thought process, though, that of that entire thing, though, is that arc towards his incredibly irrational decision making ability. Because what this looks like is, again, as we're chatting, I'm looking it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of drug use of what he was doing at that level, what it would look like to the outsider as it slow burned up there. Because in other words, you don't go from not taking any drugs to taking the volume he was taking. This is going to be an escalating slow burn. And to everyone around him, even people closer, he's high functioning, well-connected lawyer who is under stress. So he looked like he's under stress, tired, irritable, and secretive. And it's the decision-making skills of his would continually plummet. And I think the testimony that could help the lack of decision-making skills are the stupid things he was trying to do, like hire someone to kill him or wound him and then shooting himself without, I mean, that right there shows that what the drugs were doing on decision-making that manifested this.
Are you going like by his own a hand. Headshot on a...
Like see what I mean? I mean, the entire thought process for someone who's supposed to be this high thinking lawyer is, or any human being, don't even look at it from Alex Murdoch's point of view. Any human being, what thinking human being with two marbles rolling around think this is a good idea to do? You know, I mean, just think about.
I mean, I'm with you on all that, Rob.
They wouldn't. And the Alec without the drugs in his system wouldn't. But the Alec with a lot of drugs in his system did.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's my the difference. Yeah. Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to get your thoughts there. Last piece of the conversation here. We couldn't talk about Alec without it anymore. Becky Hill, always connected to Alec going forward. She's obviously pled guilty. That's done. But Jim Griffin stood at a press conference 5 days after the Supreme Court ruling and asked one question. Was she a lone wolf? The defense filed a federal lawsuit against Hill for $600,000. And that lawsuit lets them do something the murder case doesn't. Force people to sit down, answer questions under oath, and hand over documents. The retrial decides whether Alec Murdaugh is guilty. The lawsuit might tell us whether anyone helped put him away the first time. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is with myself and Robin Drake as we break all of this down. This is filed in federal court, and you are the legal scholar in the room, Bob. Why federal court when everything else has been playing out at a state level? Does this give them some sort of advantages in terms of subpoena power or depositions, or what's the strategy on this filing?
You answered your own question. Yeah, it's subpoena power.
Okay, all that.
Yeah, move on. Next question. Yeah, okay. Subpoena power for sure.
Tony's getting so good, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, they filed a 1983 civil rights claim, and essentially what you've got there is you're saying it was a government official, okay, who violated your constitutional rights under color of state law, and that's what puts it in federal court, you know. And then you've got the rules of the federal rules of civil procedure behind you. And really what it boils down to more than anything is access, you know? Mm-hmm. So because look at it like this, the criminal retrial gives the defense almost zero investigative reach right now, meaning they're going to be beholden to whatever is provided in discovery. If there's anything new, you know what I mean? Like it, after trial one, everything that was provided in the criminal case, the state criminal case, theoretically, they already have, you know. So once, and that, you know, like once that trial ended, and I think that Poot had said this, you know, their ability to subpoena anything was gone. Mm-hmm. So the civil case hands it back to them, so they could do depositions, and like we're seeing, and I know you're not really covering the Karen Reed debacle and the civil suit on that thing, but you know, it's like I kept telling everybody going into that thing because you know most true crime people don't know, you know, much about civil cases. Mm-hmm. So it's like a new thing for them. And I kept trying to tell people, like, the discovery process is a whole thing over there. Well,
I was just thinking of that, actually, of the Karen Reed debacle. Because, they're going to go in. Was Becky Hill acting alone and trying to influence the jury? Who knows? I mean, it'll be interesting to see what they find out. But at the end of the day, that really doesn't have a whole lot of bearing on this, on the actual, is he guilty of murdering his family? It's more so, how was that trial fucked up? Who was involved in fucking up the first trial?
Right.
So there's that room. But what you may glean out of that discovery through those depositions, and I'm assuming this is probably what they're doing, is any sort of police misconduct.
There it is.
Any sort of thing they can go and say, there was some shady police work going on here, and if it's shady over here, it's probably shady over there. Look at my client, Alec Murdaugh. He's wearing Karen Reed's wig today. Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he lovely?
Look at the distinguished gentleman. Yeah. Look at him.
Isn't he wild? Wonderful. That's probably what's going to happen. I'd love to see him in the Karen Reed wig. But is that the strategy here? Let's get in there and let's make law enforcement, let's make SLED the enemy here for not doing a thorough investigation, not protecting the scene. And no matter what side you are on in this case, it sucked.
Yeah.
It was shitty. It was not good. It was not good work. Was there good things? Was there some things competently done? Sure, there always is. Was there a lot that wasn't, that were just obvious failures out of the gate? Stunning amounts.
Yes.
And when you're talking about murder, you can't have stunning amounts of failures in the investigative work and expect it to be a very firm case against the person you're accusing.
100%, man. And you know what makes the Murdaugh thing so fascinating is that family's history in the Lowcountry. You know what I mean? You can't diminish the fact that that family ran that county forever.
Yeah.
I mean, to the extent where Alec is sitting in a fucking courtroom where pictures or portraits of his grandfather and father are literally on the wall.
They had to take him down for the trial.
Dude, it's like the amount of shit that they're going to be trying to dig around in terms of beefs or, you know, axes to grind, you know, was this something that could have been political and there's a much more nefarious, deeper thing behind it? I mean, they're going to be digging for it all. You know what I'm saying? SLED's definitely in there, but SLED is, you know, an arm of the government. You know, I mean, SLED is a tool that could have been used by somebody in a political position that had an axe to grind with Murdoch or that family in general and wanted them the fuck out of it. Who, yeah. Like, I mean, the world's their oyster in terms of the discovery process and what they're going to be trying to dig around for. And obviously they're going to be digging heavily into all of Becky's communications, whether it be via email, whether it's text, whether it's phone call, whatever, whoever she was communicating with, because that's the problem when you have an elected official that's doing this shit. You know, it tends to cast shade on potentially other elected officials, you know, because I mean, does anybody believe, and I guess it's plausible that Becky Hill actually thought that that piece of shit book that she wrote or didn't, you know, that a ghostwriter wrote was actually going to become some kind of bestseller. And she was like delusional to the extent completely. Where she thought, oh, well, I mean, you know, I mean, that's a plausible theory that she's a, you know, the lone gunman, so to speak. But, you know, I think it's also plausible to think that there were other people involved that just wanted the Murdoch family to be done in that county for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Sled's conduct was out of their norm as well for the missteps. Because anytime I'm looking at anything, I'm always looking at, you know, arcs, probabilities, how rational is it? And, yeah, people in law enforcement make mistakes routinely. I mean, we cover so much of it here, and which is normal. You're normally expecting yeah. wobbles along investigations. But, yeah, in this investigation in particular, there is many more wobbles than are normal by Sled.
What I find really interesting in this case is, I mean, I'm going to make an assumption here that Alec Murdaugh was getting some special treatment because of his connections with Sled, because of his position of power in the community, because of the legacy, because of all of that.
Right.
And at the end of the day, that special treatment, quote unquote, that he was getting is going to be used against them for saying you didn't. But at the end of the day, if they went in there going, there's no way Alec did this. Somebody else did this. Why would you be handling this in such a kid glove sort of shitty way if you're going to want to find the actual killer who did this? Wouldn't you be like even more like, shit, this is like a big dog in town. Dot the I's and cross the T's. Make sure we don't fuck this up. He's an attorney too. He's going to make sure we're not screwing it up. But instead they went in such a sloppy way. I mean, I guess that just speaks to they were just sloppy in general, but it seems the special treatment that ended up just being sloppy treatment is the thing that could have either exonerated Alec if there was somebody else involved here and they didn't get prints off doorknobs, all sorts of obvious shit, or completely screw him. Because they didn't do a good enough investigative work. It really is just kind of baffling. And I think the answer at the end of the day is simply incompetence.
Yeah, you know, it's common sense dictates exactly what you just said. You yeah. know, that if he, and again, it's not just Alec, it's that family.
Yeah.
Don't ever lose sight of the fact of the Murdoch family
yeah.
and what they've been in that county. They're fucking legendary, man.
Yeah, yeah.
They were a legendary family in that county. And you would think that common sense would dictate exactly what you said. Oh, well, shit, there's no way Murdoch did this. We need to get this guy. Let's really button this shit down. We gotta crush this investigation. And then you get the exact opposite, you know, and it's look.
That's not how the brain works when you live in fear, man. You don't. So when you place yourself in their situation with that deep empathy, not empathy, you know, compassion, empathy, like what are they seeing in those moments? So here you are, you're an investigator, you're on Sled or any part of this team investigating this. And you're saying to yourself, holy shit, this is the Murdoch family. Do I want to be the one that does a really, really good job and brings down the dynasty and they pin it on me?
We're saying the opposite, but we're saying the opposite.
I'm saying
that if they go in with the mindset that Alec didn't do it, why aren't they doing a thorough investigation?
I'm saying that no matter whether they thought he did it.
You're saying that
no matter if they thought he's
trail would have led them to Alec, but
I think they would have done that no matter what, because whether they thought he was guilty or innocent, they don't want to be the one that was the facilitator of his downfall, whether they thought he's guilty or not, because they don't know how far out, because again, they've heard, they've lived under the legend of that family. they don't know what's going to come down after they had their own hand in him going to jail.
But Robin, were they thinking that far ahead in those moments? Because a lot of the sloppiness happens within the first 12 hours of this. Are the investigators thinking, I don't want to be the one that's going to get blamed for taking down this family? Do you think that's going through their mind, or is that?
I'm guessing the first thing going through their mind is it couldn't possibly be him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because like here, this was always my thing during that first trial when, you know, it became apparent and we all thought he was going to do it because of his narcissism that he was going to testify. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, and I was screaming this on my lives. I'm like, I don't know what his attorneys are telling him to say about that video. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the kennel video. But what they came up with this bizarre theory that he didn't trust Sled because of prior interactions with them was fucking ridiculous. To me, if he was my client, I would have said, well, Alec, you know, if you're trying to figure out why you lied about this thing, you know, it would make more sense that as an attorney who's handled a fair amount of criminal work, that you would know as soon as that investigation starts, you being the last one to see them live, you being the one to call it in, that you're going to be the suspect in the most logical explanation in terms of just self-preservation is that you lied about it because you were not going to put yourself any more in the spotlight than you were already going to be from the jump. You're mm-hmm. the fucking guy. So, you know, like that, at least it's plausible. It's like, well, I didn't know he was taking a video, to be honest with you. And I wasn't about to put myself down there because I think that you guys were already going to be looking at me anyway. Like that, like at least that holds water.
Yep.
Like
it does.
The whole thing with the Sled bullshit. Like I didn't trust Sled, so I didn't want to. You know, it's like that thing was ridiculous.
And I agree because when you look at the number of cases they cover a year, and in all those different jurisdictions, I mean, we're talking thousands of homicide investigations they do. They got a lot of reps because I looked that up a number of weeks ago. It's like, hey, was this like a one-off? You know, how junior were these guys? How inexperienced? No. Their reps are solid. Now, granted, they were blips out of the norm. I think those blips out of the norm is because of the impact of him being part of it.
Yeah. There's definitely so many questions, and it's going to be very fascinating to see what they dig out of all of this. Let me one more question for you, Bob. As the defense of Murdaugh, as Poot and Jim are looking at this this Dinty Moore beef stew of Murdaugh land, they're like, is that beef or is that a carrot? Do you think they know what's in the stew? Do you think they know what they're looking at in terms of this civil suit against Becky Hill, at what they're going to find? Or are they literally taking out each piece of the stew, putting it underwater, going, a pea pod?
Yeah, I think they're going into it with their eyes wide open, you know, not knowing exactly what they might find. But I think that they're going to, they're going to poke around as much as the law will allow them to, the law being the judge, in terms of what the judge is going to allow them to turn over, you know, in subpoena power world, you know, and I'm talking about Becky and her lawyers, you know, I mean, they're going to look for everything, you know, because it's that like just that rabbit hole to where they have no idea what they're going to find. And I mean, you never know what you're going to find.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? And you never know how you're going to be able to couch certain things with the stuff that you do find. You know, I mean, you could make arguments based on things that you're seeing that were texted between people that it's a little suspicious. They were texting one another about the thing, you know, or you find nothing. You know what I mean? And you're just trying to reach. But ultimately, you hope that at the end of the day that the jury is going to be smart enough to know what's what. And be able to, you know, if the defense is able to get anything in. And again, remember, the judge is always the gatekeeper, and Judge Newman's not going to be the judge again. He's retired. So like, we're going to have a full new jurist up on that bench. And it's going to be probably, I would guess, in a different county. And like, that's a thing that like heading into that trial, the first one was a fascinating aspect to me in terms of these calls that sometimes are made by both prosecutors and defense teams wherein they elect not to move for a change of venue because they feel comfortable enough in their county. And I'm talking about in high profile cases mm-hmm. where you're getting the lay of the land. That's where social media comes into play here, where you can kind of take the temperature of the community based on everything that's going on in social media in terms of the chatter. You know, like this is where the community is as a whole, or at least a portion of it. And I feel comfortable enough to not move it out of this county, because I'm like, why in the world did the defense not move for a change of venue? I'm like, I don't care that Murdoch's family has that legacy in that county. When you are up on that hill, people hate you. what I mean? Like, people, there's not some kind of like undying love for the people who have been running the county with an iron fist for as long as anybody can remember. People have disdain for you. Yeah. Like no one likes the person that's at the top of the hill. Yeah. Like, no one, you know what I mean? So to me, it was foolish to think that they were going to get a sympathetic jury in that county, knowing that that family was running shit with an iron fist in that country. And I don't know. So to me, and that was one of the first things they filed, change of venue. You know, mm-hmm. should have done that the first time, sucker, because that was the move. You know, and you've been seeing it as a trend more and more with more cases, with the high-profile cases where they elect not to move it out of the county because, and I have to believe that it has something to do with them monitoring social media and kind of seeing what the lay of the land is. So I mean, what they're going to dig up in that civil suit is fascinating. Whether it's something, I'm here for it. I'm here for all of it, you know. And whether it's nothing, I won't be shocked, because, like I said, you know, I mean, it's certainly plausible that Becky was just delusional and thought, you know, this is it. This is when I'm making my millions and I'm calling it a day. And, you know, this book is the way that I'm doing it. So, I mean, who knows?
I'm betting on delusional.
Yeah, me too.
Probably. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Links are in the descriptions. Bob Mata, go check it out. Defense Diaries, his podcast, wherever you get podcasts, and on YouTube. And there's another lovely podcast he has about John Wayne Gacy.
Yes.
Buried.
Inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation. And it's good. It's thorough. Yeah, deep,
it's good.
Deep dive.
Go check it out. Press subscribe wherever you get those podcasts. And Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. Go check it out. Amazon is where you can get it, or wherever you get books, Audible, and leave a review as well. Until next time, for Bob, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.